Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Monday, September 28th, 2020. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here is our first story. Ames Policing Report released. This story is written by Isabel Rosario. In response to an extraordinary amount of feedback about policing that the Ames City Council received after George Floyd's death, the city released a report on local policing policies on Friday evening. Floyd was killed while being restrained by a Minneapolis police officer on Memorial Day, which sparked nationwide protests and debates about policing in America. The 45-page report, which will be discussed at Tuesday's council meeting, could result in changes to the Ames Police Department's policies and practices. It addresses themes such as officer training, complaint handling, data transparency, and funding. The report outlines community suggestions, what the city is currently doing on each topic, and the city manager Steve Schranker's recommendations. Recommendations were influenced by input from the community, the police department staff, peer department activities and services, and the president's task force on 21st century policing, according to the report. Reacting to concerns about police deorganizational culture, Schranker said in the report that Ames is not perfect, but he believes that if there are isolated experiences of inappropriate behavior, they are not the result of culture bias in the city or the department. Excuse me. All Ames departments follow an initiative called Excellence Through People, which outlines 13 values, including excellence, respect for one another, and teamwork, the report says. Schranker recommends adding the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion to that initiative, and will recommend adding a full-time diversity, equity, and inclusion coordinator during next year's budget cycle. While racial profiling and bias are already prohibited in the police department, Schranker recommends banning racial profiling in all city services and adopting an ordinance that prohibits filing false police reports against an individual based on their race. Some states have passed laws criminalizing deceptive 911 calls, especially those discriminating against protected classes. During the recruiting process, prospective Ames police officers undergo a background investigation and psychological assessment that includes measures to detect bias and extremism. Schranker recommends the human resources staff explore additional evaluation tools to detect implicit bias. The police department currently participates in a variety of diversity, bias, and de-escalation training, the report says. In addition to formalizing this curriculum, Schranker will recommend converting a vacant authorized police officer position into an administrative sergeant position during next year's budget cycle. The position would manage training, data transparency, and supervision of new officers. The report refers to emails on the use of force that the City Council has received, many of which echo proposals from 8 Can't Wait, a project from Campaign Zero. In most instances, policies already exist that address these areas, the report says. In some cases, Ames Police Department policies are less restrictive than the emailed requests. One policy request is to ban chokeholds in all cases. Ames Police policy currently does not ban all chokeholds, but limits their use to situations where deadly force is authorized, following changes to Iowa law this summer. Community members have also requested the police establish a force continuum that restricts the most severe types of force. Instead of a continuum, Ames Police use force options. A continuum implies that an officer must move through a set of options in a systematic way, whereas options require the officer to evaluate the resistance and use the option that best fits the situation at hand, including using no force, the report says. Another policy request asks officers to ban shooting at moving vehicles. While Ames Police policy recognizes the general ineffectiveness of this action, it provides limited circumstances where the officer has no other alternative to avert the threat of the vehicle. Schranker does not recommend changes to police department policies in the report, but does recommend the creation of an Ames Citizen Policy Advisory Committee to provide periodic independent reviews. I'm sorry, that's a creation of an Ames Citizen Police Advisory Committee to provide periodic independent reviews. Ames will continue to use Lexapol to review existing policies, according to the report. Lexapol is a private, for-profit contractor that is popular with smaller cities and used across 35 states. The fiscal year 2021 Ames city budget puts $10,596,000 towards law enforcement, representing 4% of the city's total budget. The report states, 88% of the law enforcement budget goes to salaries and benefits, it says, for a total of $1,297,000 to expenses other than personnel services. Schranker wrote that any substantial redirection of funding from the law enforcement budget would reduce the number of officers and severely impact the city's ability to provide adequate service to the community. However, the allocation of asset funds, which support human services for low and moderate income residents, could be reprioritized to better meet the City Council's social justice goals, Schranker wrote. In response to calls for the police department to not acquire military vehicles, Schranker recommended that City Council adopt a policy that no surplus armored military vehicles may be purchased or accepted for city use. In response to questions on transparency, the report says crime statistics are a basic set of data the public should be able to obtain and review. Schranker recommended publishing quarterly summaries of citations, arrests, and uses of force with a breakdown of race and other demographics. However, he notes that the collection of demographic data is not required in every police interaction. In cases where demographics are not provided on an individual's identification card, officers will not ask or make assumptions about the person's race or other characteristics. In 2019, the Ames Police Department and Iowa State University Police initiated a study to evaluate whether racial disparity exists in traffic stops. Study results are expected this fall. To aid communication with the public, Schranker recommended making forms to document complaints more readily available on the police department website. He also recommended working Iowa State University community and regional planning classes to better reach underrepresented populations in Ames. Schranker is scheduled to present the report to the City Council during its meeting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday. Residents can voice their input on the report during the meeting, which will be held on Zoom with a 3-minute limit per person. Our next story, Arboretum reopens after heartbreaking damage. Nature destinations across the state see long recovery ahead. This story by Kylie Wellendorf and Sarah K. LeBlanc. Ames Tribune and Des Moines Register USA Network. Before the derecho, traffic at the Iowa Arboretum was fantastic, Executive Director Mark Schneider said. Since March, the Arboretum has had to close twice due to issues outside of its control. The pandemic, which shut down gathering places across the state, and then again due to an August derecho that twisted, shredded, and uprooted many of its trees. After seeing record jumps in visitor numbers earlier this year, nature centers and state parks across the state, primed for socially distanced refuge, are still picking up after the derecho at the start of what may be a year-things-long recovery process for some. There's a bunch of typos in that sentence, I'm sorry. I think what it means is a years-long recovery process for some. Though the Arboretum's been closed to the public since the storm, Saturday's partial reopening, woodland trails are still closed, meant visitors could see the changed landscape in person. Like many operations across the country, the Arboretum closed to the public in March due to COVID-19. Upon reopening in May, staff saw a spike in visitation as bars, restaurants, and some other businesses remained closed across the state. The number of guests in May, June, and July increased by 39% compared to 2019's count, Schneider said. which proves our point about people looking for places like the Arboretum to connect with nature and the outdoors. People are coming to the Arboretum because they want nature, they want to get out, and they want to connect with what we have, he said. Our revenue was up for admissions tremendously. It was really a positive thing. Leading up to the second closure, which began August 10 and ended on Saturday, visitors continued to stop by the center to experience nature. When the storm hit, it really changed the game for us, Schneider said. Nature spaces across Iowa hit a second large-scale roadblock on August 10 when a derecho storm producing extremely destructive straight-line winds ripped across the state. Schneider was working at the Arboretum when the storm hit. After stepping outside once the storm passed, he described the scene as heartbreaking. Winds of between 100 and 140 miles per hour for 30 to 40 minutes uprooted, split, and toppled some of our most valuable showcase trees. Jamie Beyer, president of the Iowa Arboretum, wrote in a newsletter, a lot of these trees took 40 or 50 years to grow and became beloved by all of our members. More than 200 trees at the Arboretum were badly damaged in the storm, 133 of them to the point that they needed to be removed completely, he wrote. In Cedar Rapids, the Indian Creek Nature Center lost an estimated 60% of its tree canopy in the storm. Marketing manager Liz Zobel said, the center is operating with limited hours and sees a long recovery ahead on its 500 acres. Our prairie trails are open again, but the majority of our trails will be closed for the foreseeable future, she said, likely at least a couple of years. This year also brought a huge financial hit for the Cedar Rapids Center. Between the pandemic and the derecho, Zobel said there is a 40% budget shortfall from canceled programs and cleanup costs. It will take a while to recover from that, she said. We're a private nonprofit that is not funded by government, so we rely on support from donors, grants, corporate sponsors, and the community. As for state parks, Palisades Kelper State Park in Linn County remains fully closed until further notice, according to the Department of Natural Resources. Lake McBride State Park in Johnson County has reopened, with certain campgrounds and trails closed due to remaining damage. All trails are closed at Rock Creek State Park in Jasper County. State parks and private nature centers watched as volunteers came together to help where they could. Large numbers of volunteers have shown up at the Iowa Arboretum, where a storm relief fund has been established to assist with expenses. Leftover funds will be used to replant more trees, according to the newsletter. The cleanup effort at Indian Creek has been nearly a daily effort, Zobel said, with hundreds of volunteers putting in nearly 800 hours of work so far. A fall tree sale that wraps up Monday has made $20,000, she said, with proceeds going to the center's recovery. Volunteers were also set to pitch in with storm cleanup and other tasks at more than 30 Iowa State Parks on Saturday as part of the State Park System Centennial Celebration this year. Between the pandemic and the derecho, I think people have realized how important nature is to them, Zobel said. On Saturday in Madrid, some visitors would get their first look at how the Arboretum has morphed due to the storm. But more importantly, Schneider said, as the opportunity to experience what the center has to offer, a taste of nature. You'll be able to hear nature again, he said. Even though it's going to take a lot more open, you'll see some of the damaged trees. And you'll still be able to see the nature continue even after a storm like this. And the next story, Macbeth. Shakespeare's Macbeth, to be performed in Boone Park this week. This story by Sarah Jordan Heinz. COVID-19 may have curtailed live performances in the enclosed spaces, but the Boone Community Theater found a way to prevail. The group will put on William Shakespeare's Macbeth at Herman Park Pavilion, located at 621 South Green Street, at 7 p.m. Thursday and Friday, and at 1 p.m. on Saturday. The classic play tells the story of Scottish General Macbeth, who receives a prophecy from a trio of witches that one day he will become King of Scotland. Macbeth murders King Duncan and takes the Scottish throne for himself, setting off a chain of events. Macbeth was adapted for the BTC by veteran theater performer Drew Zahn, who can trace his lineage to Anne Hathaway, wife of William Shakespeare. Zahn also co-directs the play along with Christopher Levi. Both also have parts in the show. The original play is exceptionally lengthy and written in King James English, so it can be a little archaic for modern audiences to understand, and it requires a cast of about 50 people, Zahn said. So with COVID, we wanted to create an adaptation that was faithful to the original story, but using an updated language and shorter in length, with fewer characters. We haven't added any modern elements to it. It's still the same fantastic story of witches and kings, Zahn said. He also said he and his family have been involved with the Boone community players for years, as well as the homeschool-based group Heart and Home Theater, where they also met the Lewis, or the Levis. Drew lives in Perry and used to live in Stratford, Iowa. Shakespeare was born in Stratford-upon-Avon, England, he noted of his connections to the Bard. I think every actor and director wants to do a Shakespeare play someday, Levi said. It's very challenging in its own right. It takes a different kind of approach and study. Josh McFarlane will play the role of Macbeth. I'm a pastor, so I'm accustomed to being in front of people, and that has given me a level of comfort to cut loose and not feel self-conscious about goofy expressions or raising my voice and throwing my hands around, McFarlane said. Boone Community Theater show will be a take on the popular Shakespeare in the Park concept. Herman Park's pavilion has a roof, ideal in the case of inclement weather, as it covers both the stage and the groupings of picnic tables. At least 100 people will be able to sit and watch the show, adhering to social distancing, but the tables seat closer to 300. There are also restrooms in the park. Cast member Autumn Weaver, who has limited hearing, said a sign language interpreter will be present at some of the shows. She encourages anyone in the deaf community to come out and enjoy the show. Longtime thespian Susan Herrick portrays three characters in the show. You rarely get to see Shakespeare live, Herrick said. We have a very talented group of players in this cast. Our Macbeth is amazing. There are three witches, and we're having a great time being creepy, spooky. The play will be filmed and shown at a later date for those not able to attend. The play is in the public domain. Boone Community Theater had to postpone its spring play, titled A Murder is Announced, due to COVID-19. It has been rescheduled for April-May 2021. The next show, which the Boone Community Theater will put on, has yet to be determined. There are a couple of plays that I'm thinking about, Levi said. I tend to like classic literature. My next one will probably be a play that is more serious on the dark side, but we will see. The play's production manager is Michelle Levi, who has been involved with the Boone Community Theater for many years. I always wanted to do Shakespeare. If they'd offered me the part of Juliet, I probably would have said yes, just to be in a Shakespeare play. I can cross this off my bucket list, McFarlane said. I've always loved this tragedies more than his comedies. I've always loved his, meaning Shakespeare's, tragedies more than his comedies, so I was stoked to try this out. Tickets are $15 for adults, $10 for seniors age 65 or older, and students. Tickets are available at boonecommunitytheater.org at Boone Community Theater's offices located at 705 Story Street on Thursdays from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. and also at the reception desk at Vision Bank located at 1704 South Marshall Street in Boone. Tickets will also be available at the performance, but may be limited by social distancing guidelines. Masks are recommended until patrons are seated and strongly suggested throughout the performance for those seated within 25 feet of the stage. A sign language interpreter will be located to one side of the stage on Friday and Saturday for those who are hearing impaired. For more information, there's a phone number to call, and that number is 515-303-0393. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press in a newspaper targeted in a Paris attack. The chief suspect in a double stabbing in Paris told investigators he carried out the attack in anger over caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad recently republished by satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo, a judicial official said on Saturday. Two people were wounded and seven people are in custody after Friday's attack, with a meat cleaver outside the newspaper's former offices in eastern Paris, which counterterrorism authorities are investigating as an Islamic extremist attack. Charlie Hebdo lost 12 employees in an Al-Qaeda attack in 2015 by French-born extremists who had criticized the Prophet cartoons. The newspaper, which routinely mocks religious figures of all kinds, decided to republish the caricatures the day before the trial into the 2015 attacks opened earlier this month. Questioned by investigators, the chief suspect acknowledged carrying out the attack and said he sought to target Charlie Hebdo because of the caricatures. According to an official close to the investigation, who was not authorized to be publicly named, discussing an ongoing investigation. Seven other persons were detained in the aftermath of Friday's attack, but one has been released, the official said. Five of those in custody were detained in the Paris suburb of Pantin, in a residence where the suspect is believed to have lived. Prime Minister Jean Castex, visiting Paris police headquarters Saturday, pledged to step up the fight against terrorism, saying the enemies of the Republic will not win. Our next story, U.S. colleges struggling to salvage the fall semester. Colleges across the country are scrambling to salvage their fall semester amid skyrocketing coronavirus cases. Entire dormitory complexes and fraternity houses are under quarantine and flaring tensions with local community leaders over the spread of the disease. Institutions across the nation saw spikes of thousands of cases days after opening their doors in the last month, driven by students socializing with little or no social distancing. Schools and community leaders have tried to rein in the virus by closing bars, suspending students, adding mask requirements, and toggling between in-person and online instruction as case numbers rise and fall. Tension over the outbreaks is starting to boil over in college towns. Faculty members from at least two universities have held no-confidence votes in recent weeks against their top leaders, in part over reopening decisions. Government leaders want the University of Wisconsin at Madison to send its students home. Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, alarmed by what he sees as draconian rules on college campuses, said he is drawing up a Bill of Rights for college students. In Rhode Island, Governor Gina Raimondo, a Democrat, last week blamed outbreaks at two colleges for a surge of virus cases that boosted the state's infection rate high enough to put it on a list of places whose residents are required to quarantine when traveling to New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. The University of Wisconsin at Madison had seen more than 2,800 confirmed cases in students as of Friday. The school shut down in-person instruction for 2 weeks, locked down two of its largest dormitories, and imposed quarantines on more than a dozen sorority and fraternity houses. Duane County Executive Joe Parisi has demanded the university send all of its students home for the rest of the academic year. The virus was under control until the university came back, Parisi said. Chancellor Rebecca Blank has fired back, saying tens of thousands of students with off-campus housing would still come to the city. She accused Parisi of failing to enforce capacity restrictions in bars and off-campus parties. At Kansas State University, more than 2,200 students were placed in quarantine or isolation since classes began. Student Emily Howard was isolated in what students have dubbed COVID jail after she and her dorm roommate tested positive for the virus on September 4, 3 weeks after arriving on campus. Brian Fisher, a University of Wisconsin-Madison freshman quarantined in the dorm, said students were allowed to leave only to get food from the dining hall, and they were given only 30 minutes to make each trip, he said. He spent his time studying and watching movies. We were pretty much stuck in here, Fisher said. Despite the attempts at mitigation, student cases have sent local county infection numbers soaring. Our next story, Disaster Recovery Center to open for a limited time. This story written by Kylie Wellendorf. Iowans seeking federal disaster assistance following the August 10 derecho We'll have a place to submit documents in person starting next week. A disaster recovery center located at North River Valley Park, that's 725 East 13th Street in Ames, will open to the public at noon on Tuesday, according to a news release from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, agency actually, that is. The center is open from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. The center will be staffed with FEMA employees who can scan documents and answer questions pertaining to the disaster assistance programs. Survivors who have already registered with FEMA and have been asked to provide additional documentation should read their FEMA letter carefully and make sure they have everything they need when they arrive at the Disaster Recovery Center, according to the release. The center will not operate in a traditional fashion, the release states. It includes drive-through service, and patrons are required to wear a mask and remain in their vehicles during the visit. In addition to submitting documents in person, they can also be mailed, faxed, or submitted to FEMA online at disasterassistance.gov. The site will close permanently at 6 p.m. on October 10th, according to the release. More information on the Iowa Disaster and Recovery Resources can be found online at disasterrecovery.iowa.gov. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Nancy Jane Hepson Riley, age 66, of Ames, passed away from complications of primary progressive aphasia, on September 22nd. Friends may call from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Monday, September 28, at the Adams Funeral Home, 502 Douglas Avenue, Ames. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, September 29th, at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church, 2210 Lincoln Way in Ames, with Father Kyle Dingman officiating. Due to COVID, masks are required and social distancing will be enforced. Burial and a time for sharing will be at the Ontario Cemetery in Ames following the service. There will be a link to view the live stream of the Mass and graveside service by going to adamssoderstrom.com and clicking on Nancy's tribute wall. Nancy was born December 12, 1953 in Grinnell to William and Elizabeth Montgomery Hepspin. She graduated from Gilbert High School in 1972 and was the valedictorian of her class. In 1973, she and Terry Riley were married and made their home on an acreage near Ames. Together, they maintained a small grain and livestock operation while raising their four children, Mary, Brenda, Lon, and Patty. Nancy was a tireless worker as Terry's partner on their farm, from walking beans and shelling corn to making the cow and weaning pigs, to tending the family garden and helping the kids with 4-H projects. She did it all. One of Nancy's many talents was cake decorating. She honed her craft for several years working in a local bakery before deciding to open her own cake business, which she ran out of her home kitchen. She had a vivid imagination, a keen eye for design, and an amazing knack for solving problems on the fly, and a strong, steady hand. Nancy had creativity in spades, allowing her to see each cake project through from conception to completion, with stunning results. This kept her quite busy with orders ranging from hand-sketched, airbrushed kids' birthday and graduation cakes to exquisite, multi-tiered, rolled fondant wedding cakes. There wasn't an order she couldn't fill, nor an expectation she didn't exceed. In 1999, Nancy chose to pursue higher education in business. She graduated from Iowa State University in 2003 with a Bachelor of Science degree in business management. She worked in data management for the pork industry and then as an associate at an investment firm. After several years, she returned to her true calling, the kitchen. She worked as a cook at UDCC, one of Iowa State University's busy student dining centers, until 2015, when her health condition forced early retirement. She loved interacting with the college students and enjoyed seeing her grandsons, Adam and Corey, when they became Iowa State University students. Nancy was upbeat and enjoyed talking with all kinds of people. She never knew a stranger. Her beautiful smile and laugh were defining and second only to her sense of empathy and generosity. She had a kind and humble heart, endearing her to all who knew her. She drew this from her strong Christian faith, which she practiced daily, always focused on others and their comfort. She took pleasure in brightening someone's day and lessening a burden. If she knew of someone, anyone, in need, she was there to help in any capacity. She invited international college students to family gatherings over holiday breaks so that they would not be lonely, and housed people in need. She visited friends and family in nursing homes regularly. She took home-cooked meals and cakes to neighbors grieving or celebrating. She acknowledged the smallest of gifts with a thank you card penned in her beautiful cursive handwriting. She kept gifts on hand to give on short notice. Nancy radiated joy and had a great sense of humor. Most of all, Nancy was a loving mother and a grandmother and a devoted wife. She loved spending time with her kids and grandkids in their various interests and activities. She took an incredible number of photographs while attending countless concerts, sporting events, and family holiday gatherings. Get-togethers will not be the same without her, and she will be greatly missed by her many family and friends. Nancy was preceded in death by her parents, her sister Lori, and her brother William. She is survived by her loving husband of 47 years, Terry, her children Mary, Riley, Brenda, and Shannon Baker, Lon, Riley, and Patty, and Tim Vogel, her sisters Susan and Sandra Hespin, and brother Howard and Judy Hespin, 11 grandchildren, Adam, Jenna, and Lauren Matthews, Coy and Tori Baker, Riley, Allison, and Trent Baker, Leah, Casey, Anna, Lindsay Vogel, and 3 great-grandchildren, Sullivan, Stetson, and Sutton Baker. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left to Nancy's family at adamssoderstrom.com. In lieu of flowers and remembrance of Nancy's life, the family asks that any charitable donations be made in her memory to the Association of Frontotemporal Lobar Degeneration, or AFTD. That's a web address, www.theaftd.org, or by mail to AFTD 2700 Horizon Drive, Suite 120, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, 19406. Our next obituary, the memorial service for Donald R. Payer. You can follow this link for a Zoom. It's a Zoom US 898-147-751-14 PWD VH DQ D XV SUX H QA DD Z VM LQ UC 8 YY LZZZZ09. Donald Payer passed away at age 91 on April 3rd, 2020, of heart disease and dementia at Green Hills Retirement Community. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, a private family memorial service will be Zoomed at 10 a.m. Saturday, October 3rd, from St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church in Ames. Burial will follow at Ames Municipal Cemetery for family members only. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Story County Boys and Girls Club, the Matthew 25 House, Ames, Iowa, or St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church, Ames, Iowa. The family thanks all who have previously sent flowers, cards, calls, and memorials in remembrance of Don. Online condolences may be directed to GrandonFuneralAndCremationCare.com. Don's obituary, previously printed, is also available at that site. The newspaper has a link to the Zoom Memorial site, so you can click on that link and take you to the Zoom Memorial service. Our next obituary, Phyllis L. Soderstrom, 100 years old, of Ames, passed away September 24th at Bethany Life Communities in Story City. Graveside services will be Monday at the Bethlehem Church Cemetery in Slater. Phyllis was born July 12, 1920, in Polk County, Iowa, to Clarence and Ella Halverson Walker. She graduated from Kelly High School in 1937 and married Lowell Soderstrom on July 12, 1939, at the Little Brown Church in the Vale. Phyllis worked as a secretary at Iowa State University in the Foreign Language Department for 22 years, retiring in 1982. She lived in Slater until moving to Ames in 1978. Phyllis was an active member of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Slater, and then Bethesda Lutheran Church in Ames. She enjoyed going to Iowa State sporting events, playing cards, bowling, traveling to different places, and she had a great pride in keeping a clean house. Phyllis is survived by her son, Dennis, and Karen Soderstrom of Story City, her daughter, Diane and Gary Herman of Urbandale, 7 grandchildren, 19 great-grandchildren, 8 great-great-grandchildren, a brother, John and Janice Walker of Slater, and 2 sisters, Norma Jean Lem of Ames and Ruth Roberts of Urbandale. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Lowell on August 27, 2004, and grandson Brad Herman. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Slater Historical Society or the donor's choice. Soderstrom Funeral Home is entrusted with arrangements. Returning to the news now, Ukraine plane crash toll now at 26. This is an Associated Press story. Searchers combing the area where a Ukrainian military aircraft crashed found 2 more bodies on Saturday, bringing the death toll to 26. 1 person survived the crash. The plane, a twin turboprop Antonov 26, belonging to the Ukrainian Air Force, was carrying a crew of 7 and 20 cadets of a military aviation school when it crashed and burst into flames on Friday night while coming in for a landing at the airport in Chugoviv, about 250 miles east of the capital, Kiev. 2 people initially survived the crash, but 1 later died in a hospital. No cause for the crash has been determined. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky declared Saturday to be a day of mourning for the crash victims and ordered that flights of an AN-26 plane be halted pending investigation of the crash cause. Zelensky, who visited the crash area on Saturday, called for a full assessment of the condition of the country's military equipment, and he said he wanted an official report on the crash by October 25. The AN-26 is a transport plane used by both military and civilian operators. Nearly 1,400 of the planes were manufactured from 1969 to 1986, according to the company's website. The age of the plane that crashed Friday was not immediately reported. And another story from the Associated Press. Lebanese premier designate resigns. Lebanon's prime minister designate resigned Saturday amid a political impasse over government formation, dealing a blow to French President Emmanuel Macron's effort to break a dangerous stalemate in the crisis-hit country. The announcement by Mustafa Adib, nearly a month after he was appointed to the job, further delays the prospect of getting the foreign economic assistance needed to rescue that country from collapse. Adib said he is stepping down after it became clear that the kind of cabinet he wished to form was bound to fail. The French leader has been pressing Lebanese politicians to form a cabinet made up of non-partisan specialists that can work on enacting urgent reforms to extract Lebanon from a devastating economic and financial crisis worsened by the August 4th explosion at Beirut port. An official in Macron's office commenting on Abid's resignation described it as a collective betrayal by Lebanon's political parties. It is indispensable to have a government capable of receiving international aid. France will not abandon Lebanon, said the official, who was not authorized to be publicly named. Lebanon is in desperate need of financial assistance, but France and other international powers have refused to provide aid before serious reforms are made. The crisis is largely blamed on decades of systemic corruption and mismanagement by Lebanon's ruling class. But efforts by the French-supported Abid have hit multiple snags after the country's main Shiite groups, Hezbollah and Amal, insisted on retaining hold of the key finance ministry. Their insistence emerged after the United States administration slapped sanctions on two senior politicians close to Hezbollah, including the ex-finance minister. The two groups also insisted on naming the Shiite ministers in the new cabinet, and they objected to the manner in which Abid was forming the government without consulting with them. After a short meeting with Lebanon's president, Michael Aoun, on Saturday, Abid said his efforts hit a dead end. "I have apologized about continuing the mission of forming a government after it became clear that a cabinet, according to the characteristics I had set for it, would be bound to fail," he said. The Lebanese pound dropped against the dollar following his resignation, trading at more than 8,100 Lebanese pounds on the black market on Saturday. Lebanon, a former French protectorate, is mired in the country's worst economic and financial crisis in its modern history. It defaulted on paying back its debt for the first time ever in March, and the local currency has lost nearly 80% of its value amid hyperinflation, soaring poverty, and unemployment. Talks with the International Monetary Fund on a bailout package have stalled. The crisis has been compounded by the coronavirus pandemic, and more recently by the August 4th explosion at Beirut's port, caused by the detonation of thousands of tons of ammonium nitrates. And here's today's Nation and World Watch. A deadly microbe water warning lifted for all but one Texas city. This comes to us from Lake Jackson, Texas. Texas officials on Saturday lifted a warning for all but one Houston area community to stop using tap water because it might be tainted with a microbe that attacks the brain. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality warned the Brazosport Water Authority late on Friday of the potential contamination by Naegleria fowleri. I'm going to spell that Naegleria. Fowleri. On Saturday, it lifted that warning for everywhere but Lake Jackson. The advisory will remain in place until the system has been flushed and tests show the system's water is safe to use. HUD Secretary's notes show he is upset with the White House appointments. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, inadvertently, his anger with the White House hiring office show when cameras captured writing on the back of a page he was using for a speech. Referring to the White House Presidential Personnel Office, the note said, "I am not happy with the way the PPO is handling my agency." The office, run by John McEntee, fills political appointments to federal agencies. "I like John and respect what he is doing. However, I am sensing a severe," and then in parentheses the word illegible, end parentheses, "of trust," the note said. Greek police arrest three people and seize 500,000 ecstasy pills. Thessaloniki, Greece, this story comes to us from. Greek police said Saturday they seized two vehicles carrying 500,000 ecstasy pills and arrested three people. The operation took place Friday in Thessaloniki, Greece's second largest city. The street value of the pills was $11.6 million. First, police arrested a 56-year-old Greek truck driver and found 180,000 pills in the vehicle. Shortly afterward, police stopped a car loaded with 320,000 more pills. They also arrested two Iraqis, ages 49 and 52. Police are looking for a fourth person. Australian health official quits in the probe of quarantine lapses. This story comes to us from Melbourne, Australia. Jenny Makakos, the health minister in Australia's Victoria state, has resigned from the fallout of an inquiry into why security guards were used instead of police or the military at quarantine hotels. Lapses in security at the hotels were given as the major reason for a second wave of COVID-19 cases. Melbourneians, who have been locked down for more than a month, are waiting for restrictions to ease on Monday, with a staged return to school for some students and outdoor gatherings of five people or more. And here's the Dennis the Menace comic for today. Mr. and Mrs. Wilson are standing in their yard on their side of their white picket fence. Mrs. Wilson is tending her flowers. Mr. Wilson looks like he's got a rake in his hand. He's been raking or doing some kind of yard work. On the other side of the fence, out on the sidewalk or somewhere, Dennis is running somewhere. He's turned, looking behind him with a look on his face like he's running away from something. He's got a very concerned look on his face. He's running pretty fast. And Mr. Wilson says to Mrs. Wilson, "He always looks like he's making a getaway." And here's the real life comic for today. A man is sitting in his easy chair with his feet up, and his wife or significant other lady friend walks up to him. And she says, "Good news, they've opened up the gyms again." And he looks at her with this very tired look on his face, eyes closed. "And this affects me how?" he says. Our next story, Google's search business targeted in looming U.S. antitrust case. This story comes to us from Bloomberg. Google's search engine, one of the most profitable businesses in history, is about to face its biggest challenge as the United States government readies an antitrust lawsuit accusing the company of crushing competition to protect and extend its monopoly. After a 14-month investigation, the Justice Department is honing in on whether Google skews search results to favor its own products and whether it uses an iron fist over access to users to shut out rivals, according to people familiar with the matter. Google, which controls about 90% of the online search market in the United States, has long been a target of rivals that complain it's used that power to snuff out competition across the internet. What started out as a college research project in the late 1990s now generates about $100 billion in highly profitable revenue every year. The search engine decides the fates of thousands of businesses online and has funded Google's expansion into email, online video, smartphone software, maps, cloud computing, autonomous vehicles, and other forms of digital advertising. European competition regulators have fined Google billions of euros for breaking antitrust laws, but United States enforcers have left the company mostly untouched since the Federal Trade Commission closed a probe in early 2013 with no action. Now, Attorney General William Barr is on the cusp of what could be the biggest U.S. monopoly case since Microsoft Corporation was sued by the government more than two decades ago. Barr has been a key ally in Donald Trump's crackdown on technology giants. The U.S. president has railed against internet companies for allegedly censoring conservative viewpoints online. While some involved in the Google case expect it to be filed as soon as next week, that timing will likely be pushed back, possibly to the following week, according to two people familiar with the matter. State attorneys general and Justice Department lawyers have been discussing final preparations for the case this week in Washington. The people asked not to be identified, discussing private matters. Senior Justice Department officials met with Google representatives this week to discuss two prongs of the investigation, search bias and search distribution, according to one of the people. Search bias is the allegation that Google skews results to favor its own properties, such as a shopping service, travel bookings, and local business listings. Search distribution centers on arguments with device makers and other partners to provide Google searches as a default to users. In 2018, Goldman Sachs estimated Google paid Apple $9 billion to get its search engine on Apple's Safari web browser and other prime spots on Apple devices. It's impossible for small search engine competitors to compete with Google's deep pockets and outbid it for valuable placements like Apple's browser, according to Gabriel Weinberg, chief executive officer of DuckDuckGo, a private-focused search provider that has complained to the Department of Justice about Google. During a recent congressional hearing, Google executive Don Harrison argued that the company doesn't dominate the markets it operates. Google may lead when it comes to general searches, but for product queries and other commercial searches, consumers are more likely to start on Amazon.com, he noted. The Justice Department and states also are investigating Google's conduct in the advertising technology market, where Google owns many of the systems that deliver display ads across the web. Some Democratic attorneys generally briefed on the case want the Justice Department to include ad tech in the lawsuit and may file their own complaint after the November election, one of the people said. The Justice Department declined to comment. Competitors have complained that Google funnels excess search market dollars to its display ad network. That extra money can account for large portions of digital publisher revenue, making them less likely to drop Google for a rival ad tech provider. U.S. investigators have asked detailed questions about how to limit Google's power in the search market, according to DuckDuckGo. In Europe, regulators have forced Google to give consumers a choice over which search engine they use on Android phones. We're pleased, it seems like the DOJ, unlike any other government in the world, is going to finally address the elephant in the room, Google's obvious overwhelming and anti-competitive dominance in the search, a spokesperson for DuckDuckGo said. Consumers would benefit from a world without search defaults, where they could easily choose their preferred search engine. Google has engaged in an array of practices aimed at maintaining its control over the search market and preventing competitors from gaining scale, said Gene Kimmelman, a senior advisor at Public Knowledge, which urged the Justice Department to this summer to investigate Google's conduct around search. Consumers have lost out as a result because rivals are effectively shut out from competing to build better search offerings, he said. Search is the fundamental motivator for the pattern of behavior by Google, and all of it appears designed to maintain a monopoly, Kimmelman said. A research paper published in June by the Omidyar Network, an organization that advocates for more aggressive antitrust enforcement against tech giants, outlined several scenarios where Google may have violated antitrust laws. The exclusive deal with Apple has helped solidify its monopoly by preventing competitors from reaching consumers, the paper argued. Google created a similar effect with its Android mobile operating system and agreements that effectively forced handset makers to pre-install Google's search engine and browser on their phones. Those restrictions made Google the default search service and further prevented rivals from gaining market share, according to the Omidyar paper. The European Union also fined Google over this. And here's another Dennis the Menace comic from Saturday. Dennis is in timeout. He's sitting in his little rocking chair facing the wall. And Dad comes home. Apparently, Dad has probably asked him why is he in timeout. And Dennis says, "Mom said I didn't have to say anything. My face did all the talking." And here's the real-life comic for today. Husband or man is sitting at the dining room table, and he's reading his newspaper. And the spouse or significant other lady, woman, comes in. And she says, "Question, do you ever spit in the kitchen sink?" And the man says, "As far as you know, no." Returning to the news then, landlords suing to push back against eviction ban. This story comes to us from Memphis, Tennessee. It's an Associated Press story. As millions of Americans struggle to pay their rent during the coronavirus pandemic, landlords are going to court claiming that the national eviction moratorium unfairly strains their finances and violates their property rights. At least 26 such lawsuits have been filed by property owners this year, including several federal challenges of President Donald Trump's directive, delivered by the Centers for Disease Control, that broadly prevents evictions through the end of the year 2020. In Memphis, seven landlords, who together manage or own more than 5,000 rental units, sued this month, accusing Trump and other federal officials of unconstitutionally violating their due process protections and wrongly preempting state law. The National Apartment Association joined a separate federal lawsuit this month in Georgia against the CDC. Another legal battle has been filed in Ohio. All plaintiffs have tenants in units who are delinquent in the payment of rent and who would be otherwise lawfully evicted from their units. But for the halt order, the complaint in Memphis says, these landlords are required by law to spend money on repairs and upkeep of the rental homes, but they are not getting federal help under the ban, it says. Housing advocates worry that overturning these bans could cause homelessness to spike, forcing people to crowd into indoor spaces and shelters, and worsening the spread of the infection. The CDC's directive, which took effect September 4, is based on the agency's broad powers to protect public health. The agency put it in the context of other historic, unprecedented, and exceedingly rare government responses to the pandemic, and said stopping evictions is an effective way of preventing the spread of the coronavirus. To be eligible for this protection, renters must earn $196,000 or less for couples filing jointly, or $99,000 for single filers. Demonstrate that they have sought government help to pay the rent, declare that they cannot pay because of COVID-19 hardships, and affirm that they are likely to become homeless if they are evicted. The CDC's directive was handed down just as many other eviction bans, including the CARES Act eviction moratorium, which covered an estimated 12 million people in federally supported housing, were set to expire. This sparked alarm, since more than 20 million renters live in households that have suffered COVID-19-related job losses, according to a report from the Aspen Institute. Still, housing advocates have offered only tepid support of the moratorium, warning that without more federal help for people who are unemployed and behind on their rent in pandemic, it only delays a pending eviction wave. I think there are still a lot of people struggling economically. Those are the people who are being kept in their housing right now because of the CDC order, said Katie Ramsey, an assistant law professor at the University of Memphis. The CDC's order notably did not include financial help for landlords, forcing many to consider selling their properties as rents go unpaid. This could ultimately cause an even greater loss of affordable housing. In a way, I'm surprised it took so long for this lawsuit to show up, Mason said. And I'm afraid that's all that we have time for today for the Ames Tribune for this Monday, September 28th. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS.